Now, shortly, we're going to be talking to Garrett Rappenhagen. He's in, I believe, in Denver, Colorado. And I'll just tell you again, the occasion for this interview is that this film and it's having an impact. And there's a lot of people playing dumb, you know, say, oh, it's just a story or it's just a movie. And a character study is one of the phrases they use. But I'm seeing a lot of anger, and I'm noticing the rumble in the American culture as people go at it with each other about wars and just wars and legal wars and illegal wars and veterans turning against veterans, et cetera. And I believe that there's been an effort to trump everybody by saying, well, here's the hero and you must follow. And that sets a bad context. But I believe we are joined now by Mr. Garrett Rappenhagen. Are you there, sir?
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Well, we're really glad to be talking to you. You've written an article with a great title, I Was an American Sniper, and Chris Kyle's War Was Not My War. Of course, this interview, the occasion for it is this blockbuster movie. Everybody's supposed to be taking away from it. And at this moment, your president, President Obama, is saying he's about to start another mission into the region in which you served. I guess I want to start with this thing. When you say that Chris Kyle's war was not your war, there were how many people served there? It was a lot of people who have to discuss whose war this is and what was the mission. When you went to Iraq, for example, and we're apparently going to go back to Iraq, but what was the mission?
Well, I went to, in 2004. It was considered Operation Iraqi Freedom 2. There was immediately already things changing on the ground from the initial invasion. We went in on the pretense of nuclear weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein was preparing to use them against the West, and if something needed to be done urgently, or else it could have been a catastrophe and a smoking gun. There was still a lot of belief that there were ties to the terrorist attacks of 9/11 and Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and these things started to become obvious that they weren't true, and the enemy that we thought we were going to fight, which were these terrorists, oftentimes turned out to be Iraqi locals fighting basically resistance against what they perceived as an occupying force in their country.
Mm-hmm.
So when I use that title, it could mean a lot of things, I suppose, but mostly, I mean that for an individual soldier, we all have different perceptions and different means of going, joining the military and serving.
Mm-hmm. And I should mention, you're with the Iraq Veterans Against the War. That's IVAW.org. I hope everybody goes to that site. There's an expression they use, we thank you for your service. I thank you for your service for peace. I'm struck by that there are thousands of former soldiers who are trying to get the American people to debate and to the Congress to take its responsibilities before these kind of things happen. I assume that's a concern you must be working on right now with Mr. Obama, considering he's basically asked permission and getting permission from Congress for some other kind of exercise, which is going to cost a lot of lives.
Yeah, and it's believed that the authorization of force in 2001 and in 2003 sort of grants the president the ability to do this anyways. So it's just kind of interesting that he's looking to get buy-in from this current Congress to authorize them to continue this effort, basically, which I see as as just an extension of the war that I fought in when I was in Iraq in 2004, 2005. So the chaos that our military forces caused in Iraq left power vacuums and created a lot of enemies that in large parts create terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which wasn't there before us starting our occupation, and then now ISIL or ISIS or ICE, however you want to call them.
Mm-hmm. Again, this is we're speaking to Garrett Rappenhagen, and he served. You had a. I noticed you were. It's U.S. Army, right? And you were a. You had two. You were described as a sniper, but also a scout. And you served also in Kosovo. I noticed, and you had training there. What about this role? I think people would like to know about this. This film called American Sniper focuses on a kind of, and one, it's sort of like talking about a designated hitter, as though this is the only, the most important soldier on the battlefield. Your language, when you talk about your experiences, is not at all like that used by Chris Kyle and people who are very excited about his particular career. This thing, for example, I want to ask you about, where does this come from that we collect the numbers that he's the most lethal? Was that part of your business when you were serving there, that to keep account?
Well, it's not really part of the business, I suppose. I think it's something that people do, and the nature of the war in Iraq is so brutal. It's hard to tell, when a combat is finished, which usually is very, very rapid, and these firefights take place in a matter of minutes. The way we usually fight them is we return, overwhelming force against any sort of threat that you can imagine, using all sorts of types of weapons, typically crew-served weapons like 50 caliber machine guns, fully automatic grenade launchers called Mark 19s, 240 Bravo machine guns, and then countless numbers of small arms weapons against the enemy. And a lot of these times they're in urban areas, frequently at night. And when the battle's over, it's hard to say, okay, who killed who here, and who's responsible for what death. So keeping count is kind of absurd in a lot of ways.
There's another gentleman, I don't know where he fits in this, but they call him the Sheriff of Baghdad, and I was struck by, he seems to be also like yourself, he served as a sniper and with a considerable reputation. He's very unhappy with the picture portrayed. He said that is not at all like what we were doing. He's very skeptical about it. But he also said there was no counting where he was. I mean, it strikes me, are you at war? Are you in the Ripley's Believe It or Not? I read 21 football fields with a scope and someone is shot. That sounds like a sporting event. I don't understand how that had any military significance.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I was far from being a Navy SEAL. It's kind of a different category unto itself in the military. I was just a regular Army soldier. I was a cavalry scout. That's my military occupational specialty, 19 Delta. I went to basic training just like every other enlisted soldier. My specialized training was called one-site unit training. It's where combat arms specialists go. I went to Fort Knox, Kentucky, got out of that, was sent to Germany and Kosovo on a peacekeeping mission. Then I was sent to a specialized school, a sniper school called Target Interdiction School. Mm-hmm. And for 3 weeks, I came out of that and was considered a sniper, and went to Iraq under that title. But it's very different than what our military special forces would do. So I can't tell you exactly what goes on, mm-hmm. in that elite genre of soldier. All I can say is, I was mostly fighting the heat and trying to stay awake. And most of my sniper missions were fairly boring, considering what you see on the big screen in this movie.
Mm-hmm. You know, you've raised it, and I really urge people, by the way, to go to the all they have to do is Google the name Garrett Rabenhagen, and there's a, you and your fellow veterans provide a lot of interesting background, but you, in analyzing it, have been talking about the, of course, the right and duty, I would say, of a citizen to exercise his right, though a member of the armed forces, and to speak out of what, about what they're doing. But you also say that the soldiers today are not the soldiers that were in Vietnam. Those were draftees for the most part. These are people, as you've told crowds, I've watched the speech, that these are people who volunteered. They're trying to make a career out of this. And that's a different category of soldier.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've got, you know, from Vietnam, you know, most of our soldiers now are all thinking about possibly making this a career. Many of them have families and are starting, you know, starting their lives out and trying to integrate that with being in the military and going on these many deployments that is quite a burden for the average soldier. Less Americans now are serving in the U.S. military than ever before. I think it's less than 0.01% of our population is serving. So it's a burden that's shared by such a few people that not a lot of folks really understand what's going on with our military and have a very separate and disconnection from the military life. And I think that's troublesome when you've got a decision-making body such as Congress and the president who doesn't understand military service and has put people in harm's way without really considering what the consequences are going to be.
Yeah, and they... this matter, you something came up in the Kyle commentary, and you discuss it, and that's just this question of who the enemy is. And there's, of course, this language that they're savages, et cetera. A lot of debate about what the word savage is applied to, but I worry and wonder about the morale of people serving who have difficulty. If you're fighting against an insurgent is not somebody who's in uniform. And you can really quickly turn this into racial issues or notions of, you know, demonizing whoever that is out there. But they're not in uniform, right?
Well, no, there's no state uniform, of course. You know, you can tell sometimes a Mujahideen fighter than from another type of fighter based on what kind of clothes they do have, but it's not a uniform per se. And no, you know, we don't know who exactly, you know, is our enemy when we're roaming the streets. I think there's a cause for dehumanization of any enemy in any war, but given a certain war, especially like what I fought in Iraq and what we're seeing in Afghanistan and probably here very soon again, with ISIS, you're going to see, you know, an attempt to really dehumanize that enemy, and it creates almost anybody becomes the enemy at that point, especially when you've got so many people, Americans, who never been across the country's line. They don't have passports. They've never visited other countries, so... you know, many of our military are somewhat xenophobic. We don't understand the culture, the language, the people, the religion, and you can imagine what sort of issues that could cause.
Yeah, I'm reminded of a great American poet. He wrote a poem, Candace Patchen said, they used to say, join the army and see the world, and he turned it around and said, join the world and see the army. You know, I thank you again for your candor in telling this thing of going in, breaking into people's homes in the middle of the night, et cetera. You were on missions where you didn't have a translator, but yet you were bursting into homes looking for people. I can't think of a easier way for a lot of people to get hurt fast.
Yeah, and when we did house raids, we had a checklist that we were supposed to abide by. It's kind of like a flow chart. If the family had contraband or you know weapons, they were in category A. If they didn't have identification cards, they're in category B. And if they didn't live in that home and were there for some other reason, they're a category C.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who fit that, any of those three lines would be detained and brought into our military base and questioned by usually contractors and military intelligence trying to figure out who they were. And a lot of those folks were never seen of ever again. I think they went to Abu Ghraib or other places like that. And, you know, we would have their families at our front gate then the following days looking for them, wondering where they went. And we never really had an answer for them. We never knew. So,
mm-hmm.
these folks in this house raid definitely were, you know, had a right to be afraid once the American soldiers banged down their door.
You used a term in your article about how the mission became unraveled, and I noticed you were on Democracy Now! With a Sergeant Bruner, I think his name was. He made the observation that, well, it wasn't him, it was a second sergeant, who said that he was proud of his unit because it was a disciplined unit and that it had a clear chain of command. But also, when you used the word unraveling, he identified other units as not being so disciplined. I want to ask you about that. It bothers me when I see somebody who says he's serving in the U.S. military, but he has painted on his own gear a death mask. I think it's called a Punisher, but it's clearly a skull. And also where the unit talked about that group and said that they had no uniforms. I mean, in other words, they were sort of point of pride that they weren't really in uniform. If you're trying to run a decent military, you cannot, in my opinion, have that sort of thing. Was that common, and what do you think of that?
It's only common within special forces like the Navy SEALs, you know, the special forces, you know, folks, Delta, folks like that. Very commonly aren't uniformed, and in a lot of cases, you know, it helps helps to mask their identity so they could be seen as individual operatives and not part of the collective of the U.S. military. But yeah, I mean
somebody's losing their grip.
I mean, the skull's ridiculous. We were actually told when we were in theater not to mark our uniforms because we didn't want any reason for the Iraqis or our enemy to identify us specifically. So if we were in a firefight, we didn't want them to know the guys driving around town the next day were that same unit. So, you know, we didn't want to kind of call ourselves out. So we didn't mark our vehicles or our equipment at all with any sort of special significance to identify us.
You didn't go through the neighborhood putting up graffiti and inviting them to come fight you?
No, you know, I mean, that might have some sort of intimidation tactic to it, but as far as we were concerned, you know, riding around town with guns sticking out of every window and off the top of the roofs of these trucks were plenty scary enough, so we didn't need to scare anybody any more than they already were.
Well, it raises a bunch of issues. You know, one of the things the veterans organization is pointing out, you're there, you have allies. You're there, according to the language, to support an existing government who happens to be primarily Muslims. And then we have a film in which a character says that he puts a crusader cross on his arm because he wants people to know he's a Christian. Could there have been any doubt from anybody that he was a Christian? You know, and that's where I come back to this uniform thing. Is anybody in charge here? I don't understand, because if you're the Iraqi soldier who's allied with you and you see that sort of thing, I mean, that makes for bad blood, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it very well could. I think that, you know, even in the military, I served alongside Jewish soldiers and Muslim soldiers and, you know, all part of this the U.S. military in Iraq, so...
Yeah, you know, have a separation of church and state in the military, right? You're a U.S. Army, he is Navy SEALs, a Marine is a Marine, he's not a Muslim Marine or a Jewish Marine.
I mean, there's there's chaplains in the U.S. military for the Wiccan faith, for the Satanic faith, for, I mean, any religion out there you can imagine. So it's supposed to abide by all these very liberal laws for freedom of religion. But, you know, obviously that's not always the case when you have a commander in chief talking about the fact that it's a crusade and, you know, other facts that identify, you know, mostly a kind of a generic view of the West as being a Christian world. It becomes very difficult when you start reinforcing that with Crusader tattoos.
You had, were you over there when they had a commanding officer had to be removed because he was bringing in Bibles or something? He thought he was on some special mission or missionary.
Yeah, I don't think I was there at the time. You know, and it was never really a huge issue while I was serving. So, you know, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, in America, I think our nationalism and patriotism has taken over any sort of real religious means, and I think that's kind of more of what, you know, our enemies were fearing more than the kind of a religious war. Was this war against just their way of life, and I think that's kind of was more dangerous to us than their talk of religion and Bibles. But I know any time that we damaged a mosque or insulted the Quran, we often had a whole lot of firefights the preceding days.
Mm-hmm. We do seem to be having a cultural war within the military about what constitutes a good soldier. You have put forward the model of a soldier who, and I saw you give this lecture, a very good one, where you told people, exercise your rights, do it within the regulations, but keep yourself together, right? Then there's this other model that you're a warrior. By the way, I have trouble with the word warrior. I served in the Marine Corps. I never thought of myself as a warrior. You're in the Marines. If you're in the Army, you're in the Army. This warrior is a category that you don't need in order to serve.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a strange one when you consider only, one out of eight service members in the U.S. military have any sort of combat role. There's a whole lot of people out there that just support you to get you to the fight with the weapons and equipment that you need, with the transportation, with the medical resources, with food in your belly and gas in your fuel tank, and all these people are doing a lot of work, and they might not really consider themselves warriors, but they certainly are devoted towards the mission. So it's strange, and I think, you know, a good soldier or bad soldier or what that is, and really just somebody that does their job, you know, you're allowed to disobey an unlawful order, but you know, it becomes clouded whether you can disobey, you know, just being deployed somewhere if you think it's unlawful for that deployment. So you've got to fight your battles and know what you can resist and what you can't without going to Leavenworth. And we have a lot of folks that have the courage to resist everything. And, you know, mm-hmm. I certainly respect those folks, and a lot of them are up there in Canada right now trying to seek asylum and citizenship, and those folks are sacrificing everything.
That raises a word which you use a lot, and I'm glad you do, moral. You have moral wounds, and then you have moral courage, which seems moral courage seems more rare than physical courage, don't you think?
Well, absolutely. You know, a lot of times I felt like I was doing my job in Iraq because I was afraid not to. I was afraid of what the repercussions and the consequences were if I disobeyed and where I would end up. So it takes an immense amount of courage to decide that you don't want to do that. I think facing the criminal court in the United States, and especially when the Uniform Code of Military Justice is a separate legal system altogether than our civilian legal system, it can be very scary, and most people don't really have a fair trial and end up in prison. So, you know, when you make that decision to resist fighting, it takes a lot of moral courage.
Yeah. We're speaking to Garrett Rappenhagen. But you, You're called a specialist. Were you a sergeant? What was your rank? What is that?
Yeah, I was a specialist. It's an E4. I was asked to go to the NCO school, and I declined because I knew I was getting out of the military. I didn't want anybody to waste their time teaching me how to be a sergeant. And I told my commander, I said, look, I'm not going to ever order somebody to do something that I would never do. So I'm probably not your guy.
Yes.
So I remained a specialist until the day I got out of the military. I was stop loss anyway, so I served involuntarily for 10 months when I should have been out of the military anyways. So
is that
the backdoor draft.
Yeah, we heard a lot about stop loss. Has that matter been resolved? Anybody in that situation?
It has, but I wouldn't be surprised if it comes up again. Like I said, there's the military population is very small, so
yeah.
if these folks end up going back to Iraq and Syria and everywhere else, I imagine they'll probably recontinue the stop loss because they just don't have the personnel to be able to fill these boots.
Mm-hmm. Another thing to do with discipline, morale, and expertise, a matter, and by the way, Sniper does seem to be a very special place. The film American Sniper, and certainly the book, is very manly and very macho, and the U.S. military is open now to women. I don't know if it ever occurred to Chris Kyle that some of the most decorated snipers of World War II were women. Because he talks about anybody who can't perform, he uses an expletive to describe women. That should be a worrying point, shouldn't it? If we're going to go down that road, you end up pretty negative towards the rights of women, gays, other people.
Well, women are naturally better snipers because
they understand men.
I think it has a matter to do with breathing control and some other things that make them a better shot, at range. And it's.
I wish that argument had been put in the middle of that movie. we got you here, Chris, because we couldn't get a woman who was and said, "But you're doing a fine job. Don't get depressed."
it's sad. It's definitely. Language that I had to retrain myself not to say. And
well, I'm glad you said what you said.
Yeah, well, it's. I think it's a challenge for a lot of our military that is being forced into these roles of this kind of macho attitude that, it's almost like sometimes if you didn't get a kill in Iraq, you were a lesser man. And, it's kind of sad that these attitudes kind of progress in the military, but takes a lot of conditioning once you get out to realize what kind of hurtful language that is. And it's sad because here Chris Kyle is with a daughter, and it's probably not the best thing to say to his own daughter, but regardless, it's kind of a way that we're under an enormous amount of peer pressure in this culture of the military to try to be this way and to compete with each other and constantly be harder and better. They'll use any sort of way to insult you or to degrade you to try to break you down and build you up the way they want it.
You could argue it could lead to bad soldiering if people start killing folks in order to say they have done it, because that really isn't the purpose of a battle. The purpose of the battle is to win. And also, if wars are driven by political gain, political interests. If you want to win over the populations so that you can arm them and let them defend themselves, you can't be treating everybody like a potential target.
Well, I totally agree, and I think that's why the United States is in this case where our national security, I think, is less than what it was before we entered the war in Iraq. And it's that sort of attitude. With indiscriminate drone strikes and with over oppressive military tactics and occupations like Iraq, that is has mm-hmm. caused kind of our international credibility to be weakened, and allows terrorist organizations to recruit in a very weighted way to to where we prove that they're right when they start talking about the evils of the West. It's plain to see when they can't sleep at night because they're afraid of drones.
Yeah. Again, it's Garrett Rappenhagen, and I want to make sure I say there's incidentally, you've written some good poems. I congratulate you on the duffel bag. I have a sea bag, and I was wondering why it's always sitting there, and you explained to me why in your poem, so thank you. Now, but about helping veterans, isn't there some, I'm getting a phenomenon that everybody's unhappy with the Veterans Administration. They don't seem to be doing their job, and we have 18 to 22 suicides of veterans every day. But also I see the growing trend towards some privatization with people having these odd ideas about ways to help vets. What do you think is the best way to help the vets?
Well, I think you need to fund the VA is the first step. I mean, really haven't given it a chance. It's been underfunded probably since it's been created. So, you know, without adequate funding, you're going to cause all sorts of infrastructure problems, management problems, people trying to cover up issues that are made only because there's not enough doctors and there's not enough money to go around. You know, there's so much limited tactics that doctors are able to use to try to fix somebody that they just throw pills at them and medication and hope they get better because they have so many folks to see and, you know, sometimes they're on a rotating basis. So, you know, I think just actually funding the VA will probably help it the most, you know, and, you know, there needs to be a lot more research and development that goes on working with veterans to learn what the problems is. And, you know, that's been one of the biggest things that's been cut with such the funding problems that they've had. So it'll be sad to see the day if everything is contracted out and broken up, because I really don't think that that's going to solve the problem, and I don't think that veterans are going to see the care that they need.
Yeah. By the way, in your poem, you say if we don't stop wars, we'll never lose, or something.
Yeah.
And these wars are providing a harvest of people who are not being looked after. Garrett Rappenhagen, we're very grateful you took the time. That's a wonderful article, Salon, and ivaw.org. Everybody should go there. Thanks again.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, Doug. Bye-bye. That's Garrett Rappenhagen. You've been listening to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Write to us, Taylor@CIUT.FM. We'll see you next week.